Right now, Wisconsin is home to a long and rich agricultural history, and as we enter the spring and summer months, we'll start to see bustling farmers markets pop up all over the place.
We're going to see fresh veggies and fruit along with homemade goods like cheeses and breads, and a growing number of those crops are coming from farms owned and operated by women in Wisconsin.
Joining us now to talk about women and farming is Lisa Kivirst. She's the author of Soil Sisters, a toolkit for women farmers, and she's the owner of In Serendipity Farm and Bed and Breakfast outside of Monroe. Lisa, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Hey, thanks so much.
Well, are you seeing a rise in interest in farming among women in Wisconsin?
You bet. It's actually national that the number of women-owned farms is growing. Here in Wisconsin, we've increased over 25% in the last 15 years. And that growth is really stemming from women who are starting very locally focused, sustainably minded operations that really want to get healthy, fresh food into our communities.
Right. That's a trend we've seen in a lot of newer farms, I think. Not so much necessarily the larger scale commodity style farming, but a lot of maybe smaller, maybe a boutique, some people call it, or niche, but smaller and more sustainable efforts.
You bet. You bet. It's women who want to get their hands back in the soil and good food back in our communities.
Among the women you know in farming, is the story usually they grew up in a farm family, they're returning to their family farm, or is this people maybe with no farming at all in their background?
You know, it crosses the gamut. These increases in women-owned farms is coming in many cases from women in their 40s and 50s that I write about in the Soil Sisters book and call encore farmers, of women who are coming from a variety of different careers, from corporate cubicles to finance to other, but are making a decision to really follow their dream of owning a farm. So you see that, but then on the flip side, you also see women returning to family land and coming to it with conservation in mind and wanting to steward the land and steward it for future generations to keep farming here in Wisconsin.
Let's talk about those first-time farmers. I think one thing that everybody, I think, knows about farming is that it's not easy. It's not for everyone. For that first-time farmer, men or women, what are some of the challenges that they face to get into it?
Well, there's a number of challenges. One, of course, is land access and having the finance and capital to get started. We're fortunate here, particularly in Wisconsin, as MOSES, the Midwest Organic Sustainable Education Service, is based here, which is the hub of organic farming information. I work with them and direct our women farmer training program. So there's a lot of good resources like that to access, of both connecting with other farmers and getting mentors, so you don't have to do it alone, and you don't have to necessarily make the same mistakes we all made in the beginning. But the information is really in a plethora state right now, and that's different than it was 10, 20 years ago, pre-internet, pre-organizations like MOSES. So it's a good time to get started.
Are there any particular barriers facing women who want to go into farming?
Historically, there definitely have been, to the point that there is currently a class action claim settlement on behalf of women, who've been denied farm loans, for example, in the past, going into the Farm Service Agency office and denied loans based on gender. But to the USDA's credit, they've really embraced that challenge and are very open to working with women and other minority farmer groups to help access the resources that are available. But for women, in many cases, the best spot of information is other women. That's what our MOSES programming is based on. And the Soil Sisters book is written very on that collaborative spirit. So there's a lot of sharing of information. There's a lot of connection of resources and things and information that women need access to. For example, one area is ergonomics. I have to explain to everybody that women are built differently than men. You know, but when you look at it from a farming perspective, we carry our strength in our lower half versus our upper half that men do. We're generally shorter, you know, and a lot of the equipment, particularly the larger scale tractor type equipment, isn't built for women. So things are changing slowly, but are improving to better help women farm healthy longer.
Is the equipment starting to change to match this rising number of women in farming?
Not fast enough, in my opinion, but it is. It is. There are increasingly tools. There's a company out in Pennsylvania, Green Heron Tools, that is redesigning hand tools for women ergonomics. And it turns out the first thing that women farmers wanted when they surveyed us is a good shovel. So it's having the tools that let us really access the soil and do it in an ergonomically sound way.
How about business planning for new farmers, women farmers, and otherwise? Farming is, of course, a small business. How can people know if they're going, especially into a particular sector, a particular niche, that there are going to be people out there to buy their stuff?
Sure, sure. That's a challenge for any farm. But what you particularly see amongst women farmers is diversification. And part of that, I think, comes from our natural tendency as women to be creative and do a lot of different things. But that's where you see multiple businesses from one farmstead, like we have here at our farm in Serendipity. We run a farm stay. We do workshops and tours. And that's where you see the whole growth of the farm-to-table dinner movement and pizza farms and doing value-added product and crafts. And that really strengthens any farmer's business plan. But again, you particularly see that amongst women, of having a lot of different things going on, and that strengthens the bottom line.
We're talking to Lisa Kivrist. She's the author of the book Soil Sisters, a toolkit for women farmers. She's the owner of In Serendipity Farm and Bed and Breakfast outside of Monroe. And she's talking about women in farming, a rising number of women farmers in Wisconsin and around the country.
And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you a woman in farming? How did you get into farming? And has your farm been in your family for generations? Or are you maybe more of a newcomer? Call right now at 800-642-1234.
This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. And we're continuing our conversation now about women and farming in Wisconsin with Lisa Kivrist. She's the author of Soil Sisters, a toolkit for women farmers. She also takes a particular interest in encouraging women to become farmers.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you're a woman in farming who's not actively farming right now, give a call. Tell us your story, why you got into farming, and what your operation is all about. Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. Lisa, I was hoping you could share a couple of stories of women in farming in Wisconsin. Give us an idea of the kind of variety that's out there.
Sure, sure. There definitely is a lot of creativity out in the fields there. A couple folks actually close here in my Wisconsin Green County area is Chris Marion at Circle M Farm in Blanchardville. She runs a diversified CSA, has a lot of sheep, and as many folks do sometimes when your kids fledge, you've got some extra room in the farmhouse. So she started a farm stay bed and breakfast last year and offers some really unique on-farm experiences for her guests. And then a little bit north of me in New Glarus, Lori Stern and Leanne Power are new to farming, so they kind of fit that encore farming mold of women coming into farming with different careers behind them. But they started Lucky Dog Farm Stay and do goats and chickens and have converted the barn into a yoga studio and now also diversified into running a small cafe and restaurant in New Glarus, Cow and Quince. So actually, if folks are interested in meeting some of my local farmhood, we have an annual weekend here, the first weekend in August, 5th through 7th, called Soil Sisters, a Celebration of Wisconsin Farms and Rural Life, with over 20 women-owned farms in our Green County area for tours and workshops and different culinary events. So you'll really see that diversification hands-on, and come on down.
Yeah, you mentioned diversification earlier in those examples you gave. Really, they're finding different ways to make use of their farm, of their land. To use the corporate term, a synergy. Is that something that a lot of women who go into farming are looking for? Different ways? If they do blank, they can also do blank?
Synergy is a great word. And, you know, that's really nothing new when it comes to women on farms. Mm-hmm. We've been doing this for generations. We've been always very resourceful and making do and using up and getting creative. So right now it's just a time to do that as a business. You see a lot of women, for example, also doing cottage food enterprises here in Wisconsin under our pickle bill. And I write about that in my Homemade for Sale book out last year of how folks can get businesses started in a home kitchen. So you see women like Erin Schneider's featured in the book. She runs Laval Farm up by Reedsburg, and she cans her abundance all summer long, pickles, beets, relish, and then sells that during the winter months at different winter markets and bazaars. So that not only diversifies her income sources, but stretches it out year-round, particularly that winter months where it's not as easy to grow here in Wisconsin.
And you mentioned that a lot of women in farming in the state are doing sustainable, maybe even organic farming. What kind of things do they need to know as they get into that? What resources are out there to help, especially with those sustainability issues?
Sure. Well, Moses is a great resource for that, for all things organic and organic certification. We have a special workshop series for women starting in June called In Her Boots, and we'll be doing one actually June 3rd. I'm more on grazing and small-scale livestock. But to go the organic route and to be certified, there are specific standards and the regulations that folks need to follow. But the best first step is to get out and see other farms, and particularly other women-owned farms, and see how they transitioned their land. What did they need to do? What kind of buffers did they need? How did they work with their neighbors? What did they do for cover crops, et cetera? So every landscape's different, but there are a lot of common themes to learn from, particularly women who have been there before you.
We've heard on the show over the last few years this idea that there's a demographic problem in farming in Wisconsin. A lot of farmers aging out, and maybe where it used to be their family members, the next generation would take it up, their kids are leaving the farms. Are you seeing women farmers picking up that slack, maybe taking up those farm operations that would have been left without an owner?
Yes, that's what really gets me jazzed, is you see this amazing crop of new women, particularly women even right out of school in their 20s, who are committed to careers in sustainable agriculture. And unlike myself, you know, that needed some wandering along the way and some little career crises to get here, it's very inspiring to see women that are doing it from the get-go and doing it right and are committed to stewarding the land for the long term. We definitely need more, that's for sure. But there definitely is a strong pulse of younger women who are bringing innovation into farming. And it's not same old, same old. It's not, you know, bigger is better, but it's talking about quality and talking about how we can really care for the land.
Are you seeing a turnover, Lisa, in the sense that, you know, today's new woman farmer in 10 years is the mentor for the next batch of women farmers?
Oh, you definitely see that. There was even a study out of University of Wisconsin a couple years ago looking at Wisconsin women farmers, but it'd be the same throughout the country, and where we go to for information. And hands down, big surprise, we go to each other. We go to other farmers. And that's really the spirit that you see behind this women farmer movement here in Wisconsin, is we're not in it alone. And there's always people to ask questions, and there's women throughout the state now, and we have a whole network going on through Moses of local networks of women in agriculture. And we have a vibrant one here in the Greene County Women in Sustainable Agriculture, and it runs the gamut. It's both women who are farming as businesses, but enthusiastic gardeners and supporters of local food. And I think every new woman farmer was an enthusiastic gardener once, so there's a good bridge there, too, to help women go from, hey, this is my hobby, this is my garden, to, wait a minute, this could be a viable business for me.
Lisa, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
Lisa Kiverst is the author of the book Soil Sisters, a toolkit for women farmers. She's the owner of Inn Serendipity Farm and Bed and Breakfast outside of Monroe. She joined us to talk about women going into farming here in Wisconsin.
Coming up after the news, we look at how the Forest County Potawatomi Tribe will use a national grant to manage bat populations in northern Wisconsin.
And don't forget, it is our spring membership drive, a chance for you to support these great conversations with your pledge right now of any amount at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Ricker.
And I'm Rob Fair. There's more to come on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. The Forest County Potawatomi Tribe recently earned a national grant which will help preserve bat populations on tribal lands.
Wildlife managers with the tribe will use the grant to conserve northern long-eared bats and little brown bats in the area. The grant's part of a larger project with U.S. Forest Service to look at bat migration and the spread of the disease white nose syndrome.
Heather Stricker joins us now. She's a wildlife program manager at the Potawatomi Natural Resources Department. Heather, thanks a lot for joining us.
Yeah, good afternoon. Thanks for having me.
So what are the plans in place for your team to use this grant to learn about bat populations?
Well, so as was mentioned, in the proximate term, we're looking to investigate roosting site characteristics and movement patterns of these two bats, little brown bats, which are state threatened in Wisconsin, and northern long-eared bats, which are federally threatened. So what we'll do is we'll be trapping these two species in what are called mist nets. And once we remove them from the nets, we can affix tiny radio transmitters to them. And then we can use that to, with radio telemetry, to track them back to their roosting trees, which are the trees where females will give birth and nurture pups. And these are particularly interesting since several females will be in there in the same tree at the same time with their pups. And then hopefully we're going to also be able to track them to their feeding grounds, which will be a little more difficult since they're typically on the move while they're feeding. So we'll try to develop a method for doing that, and then we'll be able to identify those areas that are very critical to the survival and reproduction of these bats.
So once we can
identify those critical areas, then we can protect them from things like development and timber harvesting.
So having that information, Heather, will help you know, oh, we need to protect this area of forest because the bats roost here, and hopefully we need to protect this area because that's where they're feeding.
Correct. Yeah, that's the idea of the grant. But ultimately, we're actually working towards a longer-term, more complex bat conservation strategy. So this initial part that I explained, this is really going to tell us where are the bats right now, what are they using now, and how are they using it. But part of this grant will allow us to work with the Forest Service on some of their ongoing research, where they're actually taking genetic samples from the bats to study relatedness across the entire Great Lakes region. And this can help us get insight in the population structure and migration patterns between winter and summer sites. So then we can start looking at things like movement corridors and migration patterns and dispersal, and that can help us with a larger landscape scale conservation strategy.
Can you tell us a little bit about the bats involved in this project you're talking about? I understand it's the long-eared bat and the little brown bat. What do we know about them?
Well, these are two bats that have been hit the hardest, two of the bats that have been hit the hardest by white nose syndrome. So we're seeing some pretty serious population declines with these bats. So that's really the driving force behind this project, is to really try to hold on to those critical pieces of habitat for these bats while they're working on developing a cure, hopefully, for this devastating disease. These bats are insectivores, as are most bats in North America and the U.S. So these bats are really important in keeping forest ecosystems healthy by controlling these insect pests and preventing mass defoliation from the forests that are so important in the Great Lakes region.
How big an impact has white nose syndrome had on these two species, especially here in Wisconsin and in Forest County?
Well, I don't think we can really quantify yet how big the impact has been specifically for Forest County. White nose syndrome was just discovered in both Wisconsin and Michigan in the spring of 2014. So we're still waiting to really be able to quantify that. But on a national scale, since 2006, it's an estimated 7 to 8 million bats that have died in since that disease was discovered in 2006.
I know that logging is another issue at play here. How has logging impacted the bats, and how do you expect it to play into the goal that you're working toward of conservation down the road?
Well, simply put, not only are forests critical to bats, but ultimately bats are critical to the forests as well. So really, I can actually see these, you know, timber harvesting and forest health working in chorus with bat conservation. So a study like this can actually possibly ease the burden that endangered species restrictions might impose on timber harvesting, because we're seeking to identify those areas that are most critical to bat survival and reproduction. So once we can really identify those areas and those habitat features, then we can really focus on conservation of those areas while at the same time still allowing timber harvest to occur in areas that are less critical or during less critical time periods throughout the year.
We're talking to Heather Stricker from the Potawatomi Natural Resources Department, looking at a new grant that's going to help them study bats in their area and then come up with plans to help protect two major bat species here in Wisconsin. Heather, you mentioned the migration corridors you're talking about. How important is it for you, the U.S. Forest Service, to partner with, I would guess, a lot of different parties to come up with a plan to protect these bats?
Oh, yeah, it's definitely, partnerships are going to be key in this. There are several interested agencies that really have a stake in bat conservation, including some industries that I suppose you probably wouldn't think of. You know, one thing worth noting is that a recent study showed that bats provide over $4 billion worth of pest control to the agriculture industry, and that hasn't been quantified yet for the forest industry. But you can see how bats can play into the environment and as well as economy and industry, recreation even when it comes to forest health. So there's a lot of interested parties, and partnerships are going to be very important in coming up with cohesive strategies for conserving these creatures.
It seems like before white mouse syndrome, people had sometimes a kind of an irrational fear of bats and didn't like getting them in their houses. Now it seems as though they're viewed a little more kindly because they're a vulnerable population right now that we recognize has value in the ecosystem. But do you think bats still need good PR so that people care about them, or do you think people are already on board with bats?
Oh, yeah, I think bats can always use some good PR. I've actually tried to do this a little bit by getting people to maybe Google search pictures of flying foxes, which are actually out of Australia, but they look like flying foxes. So I get people to just get a glimpse of a cute bat, you know, quote-unquote cute. And that has actually turned people around a little bit. But another thing I think that people are recognizing is the value of bats in pest control. And so when we've got things like West Nile virus and the new Zika virus, I think people are taking a little bit more interest in bats. And, you know, it's terrible that it takes a human health issue to bring this to light and bring the value of bats to light. But I think that is contributing to that in some ways.
Well, Heather, can you spell out some of the timeline of this research you're doing with the grant and then hopefully being able to put something into practice?
This year, as far as the spring of this year, we'll just be doing some background research and getting together some equipment and stuff. And then starting next year, we should be able to hit the ground running with some field work, getting out there and trapping the bats and conducting our radio telemetry and locating roost trees. And then in the 2 years following that, that's when we can really start analyzing some data and doing some habitat suitability modeling and things of that nature.
Do you expect there's reason for immediate concern? We know about the white nose syndrome, but in terms of how the bat populations are faring and their health, is it urgent?
Yeah, it's very urgent. In fact, I got a message not too long ago from a Fish and Wildlife Service employee that said, take note of bats you see this year because we probably won't ever see bats like this again in Wisconsin. Hmm. So it's definitely an urgent issue, and so hopefully we can have some positive impact there.
Let's bring in a caller. We've got Katie on the line in Clinton. Katie, hi.
Hi, good afternoon. We have a house that actually has like two colonies. We can actually pinpoint where the colonies live, and they're in our house up in the eaves, up in the attic, and they've been there for, oh, Christ, years. You know, they disappear in the fall, and then they come back in the spring. I don't know if they're the little brown bat or the big brown bat, but they're one of those. Is there anything that we can do to help? I mean, we consider them our bats.
Gotcha. Katie, thanks for that call. I don't know if you have specific advice for her house, but Heather, can homeowners play a role in helping protect bats?
Oh, yeah, definitely. I think for a long time, the first reaction would be to kill a bat that was in your house. And we're kind of hoping to see some change with that. There are a lot of professional bat removal companies out there that can come in and use, it's called exclusion fencing, to get the bats to come out, but then they're not able to come back in. So if it's somebody who's not quite so friendly towards bats that really wants them out of their house and gone, really the best thing you can do is call one of these professional services that can get the bats out without harming them. If you'd like to see more bats around your yard or maybe on old buildings such as barns or something of that nature, people can install bat boxes, which are really effective for bats in the spring and summertime. They do migrate away during the winter to their winter hibernaculums, but in the summertime, bat boxes are really important for bats.
I want to go back to what you said about being told that you should watch the bats this season because you may not see them again. Does that mean there might be species that we just don't see in Wisconsin, or just that the numbers are going to be decimated?
Well, a little of both. Little brown bats are probably the most populous bat in Wisconsin up until this point. But because of how hard it's been hit by white nose syndrome, we're going to see a pretty massive drop, most likely, in little brown bats. There are other bats that actually are not cave hibernators. They're migrators, so they'll migrate down south during the winter. Those bats are not hit as hard because white nose syndrome is exclusive to cave ecosystems. So we'll still see those migrating bats, but they've never been the most populous species in Wisconsin anyway.
Heather, briefly, as we wrap up, are you hopeful that this new grant that'll allow you to study and work with bats is a good first step, a positive first step to coming up with good strategies to protect these bats?
Well, I definitely hope so. I think it's really going to help the summer bats, the bats that are out that are in their roosting trees and trying to raise pups. There is also hope for white nose syndrome. There's actually a potential cure that's being tested right now. This was actually developed by researchers with Georgia State University as well as the U.S. Forest Service, including Dan Lindner, who actually hails from Wisconsin. And they've actually been able to cure and release 75 bats that were treated in a laboratory setting. So there's some hope that this might be able to get deployed into the wild here fairly soon, and hopefully we'll see some positive results that way.
Well, Heather, good luck, and thank you so much for joining us.
Yeah, thank you. I appreciate it.
That was Wildlife Program Manager Heather Stricker talking about the Potawatomi Tribe's efforts to preserve bat populations in northern Wisconsin.